Hello, I'm Alex Goldstein.
And I'm Alex Totoro.
We're a couple of TV nerds with opinions. And this is The Thing That Gets You to The Thing, a Halt and Catch Fire fan podcast.
Today we're in Season 2, Episode 4, Play With Friends. So everyone's looking for the true meaning of connection while dealing behind each other's backs.
For those who don't already know, we're going episode by episode through the show, looking for the little nuggets of genius that keep us hooked every time we watch.
Okay then, join us in our community room.
Hooray, we're back. Sorry for the delay for anybody who has been waiting for this episode. When you're recording in the middle of a pandemic, sometimes the pandemic strikes, and indeed it struck one of us. But he's all better now, and we're back in the game. But what it did do was give us a little moment to reflect about the way that we record this podcast, the way that it's structured, to listen back to some of our favorite episodes. And we realized it's lovely that we have like a freewheeling discussion about various different things, but that might make it a little hard to follow for you guys. So from now on, with each episode, we're going to try and give it just a little bit more shape. We're not going full revolution here. We're just going to kind of go subject by subject. So maybe think about characters and then narrative or lighting and just try and go down that route a little bit more logically so that we're not looping back on ourselves.
Yeah, and the thing that I want to add on that, I think, you know, part of the reflection comes from the fact that Season 1 allowed us to explore some of these themes in a new light, almost, if you will, in terms of trying to declassify what the creators, what their vision was and how they brought it to life using all of these different devices. But we also realized that we need to move past that to understand the true meaning of what's been established. So whilst we love talking about tilted camera angles, and we still will because we like them and we feel like they're in the DNA of the show, we want to go past that and really try and bring out those details that allow us to better understand why those decisions were made in the first place rather than that initial, maybe more superficial look at it. And hopefully we can continue digging deeper as we go into Season 2. So with that in mind, why don't we talk about characters?
Let's talk about it, because this is quite a big moment for characters for this season. This season has been picking up pace since the first episode, and now we're really kind of accelerating fast now.
I mean, did you like the episode? Why don't we start there?
I did. Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting one in that if we're talking about character, it's sort of some things were no surprise and some things were a genuine surprise. So we've talked before about how we weren't sure where Gordon was going to go next. And I think the show took an interesting development with Gordon in this one. To, you know, it's still not entirely clear where he's going, but certain personality traits are now coming to the fore. So it was interesting how determined he was not to get sucked back into Joe's world. Of course he did. But there's a certain amount of beginnings of maturity showing in Gordon there, bizarrely, given his more impulsive behavior. But there's the instinct that actually maybe he shouldn't try and do this again. Maybe he should sit back and slow down and wait for inspiration to strike rather than plunging headlong into another experiment. And of course then he gets drawn in anyway because Joe is Joe.
I mean, you say maturity, and I love it when Gordon is running and or walking from being tired of going for a jog, and he sees Joe, and he's like, "Okay, I'm gonna run the last 30 seconds, and then back all tired as if I've been running the whole time." But you know, baby steps, right?
Yeah, and it's more like work maturity. Like in his private life, he is always going to be a massive baby because he has been up until now, so that's not going to change. But like, it's just this sense that the Cardiff experience has changed him in some way, that he's not like the guy he was before. He doesn't think he wants to be that guy and then very quickly gets sucked back into it. And from Joe's point of view, we've had 3 episodes now where Joe has seemed different, right? He's gone off, he's found this woman, he's settled into this thing, you know, he decided to play Jacob Wheeler at his own game and just sort of pretend that he was okay with data entry or whatever. But he is irrepressible. You can't stop the real Joe coming through. And so immediately he's now, oh, I've spotted an opportunity. And when the legit route doesn't take, he goes the illegitimate route and tries to prove it anyway because he cannot let something go.
I mean, that's changed for Joe, though, isn't it? Trying to at least, you know, it's like when you start a new job and you're like, right, the first 6 months are going to be everything that I learned from the previous one that I might have thought, you know, kind of falls by the wayside by the time that you've been somewhere so long. Now, one of the interesting things that we got this season in relation to Gordon and his maturity, which I think you make a really good point on, is it's like we had a slight time jump. I mean, we had a time jump, obviously. It wasn't illustrated in any other shape or form than the progress that was made in Mutiny, for example, or the fact that Joe's got a whole new life. But the show kind of allowed us to skip over maybe Gordon's feelings of failure across what happened or what went down in Cardiff. And it was interesting for Joe to bring up the fact that, you know, he's not responsible entirely for stifling that innovation that comes from the way the industry operates rather than what one particular person can do, which also I thought was quite mature from Joe's point of view, even though there are hints of manipulative intentions, because obviously he needs them.
That whole conversation, as short as it is, illustrates something about their dynamic really deftly. So you have a situation where Gordon stayed.
Yes.
He stayed, he finished the project, he launched the next project, he got the payout, he did all the sensible things, and Joe literally blew things up and walked away. But however many months down the line after the fact, Joe is consoling Gordon about how it went.
100%.
And that is a really kind of illuminating thing about their relationship, and maybe about the sort of view of the show in general about what it means to be successful or what it means to... Because this show's about failure, right? And how you respond to it. And it's fascinating that, you know, in a sense, you would think from the outside that Gordon was the success and Joe was the failure, right? Joe was the one that had to go crawling to his father-in-law for a job, blah, 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 blah. Gordon is the one that stayed, got the money. He's basically a millionaire-ish now. And, you know, he's doing incredibly well. And yet Gordon is the one who feels like his life has gone nowhere and needs a little bit of reassurance that the thing that he did with the giant wasn't such a bad thing. And that is, I love that. It's maybe 3 minutes of the show in total, but it just illuminates that relationship beautifully.
I mean, we saw this in the previous episode, it was, right? Where he's like unpacking all this amazing computer and tech, and he goes out and buys all the toys, all the shiny things that, you know, like, and I'm like that with photography. I'm like, right, I want these three lens. I haven't even used one. I want these three lens, and I want to buy all the kit so that I can feel like I'm mentally prepared. But sometimes that doesn't really do anything. That doesn't enable you to do anything. So
no.
It was good for the show to sort of skip over those maybe periods of Gordon, I guess, being phased out of Cardiff into his own and now moving to this phase of like, what am I going to do? And then, what do you know, Joe's around the corner with a proposition that just happens to tie into Gordon messing up everything for Cameron and Don in the previous episode. And talking about character, you bring up this specific point. Gordon, yes, is a completionist. Let's just call it that. He'll follow through to the end. But is he also someone that can't let go? Because he cannot let go the fact that he messed up Donna and Cameron's operation and just has to go and put it back in.
Absolutely. He doesn't know when to leave well enough alone.
Yeah.
And the problem is that, like, Gordon has a history of having, like, he does have decent ideas. He's not completely lacking in ideas or vision.
Oh, yeah.
But his ideas seem to collapse, right? The Symphonic, we don't know exactly what happened with that, but we know it went to pieces. Sonaris, we don't, we know that was well-intentioned and then ended up going to pieces. In spite of that, he sort of carries on trucking on and wants to finish things and wants to see. And for Gordon, I think done is better than perfect. Whereas for Joe, it's all about the big vision, right? The big idea. And that takes us actually really nicely to clash of inspiration that's now happening between Cameron and Donna, because unlike the Joe and Gordon situation, Donna does have a good idea. She has an idea that we, the audience, know is going to work, right? We're looking at it from the point of view of people who have now lived through, you know, Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and all the rest of it. We know community is going to be a success. We know the idea of community. Whether or not her specific one at Mutiny works is another thing, but we know the idea of community is going to take off. And so, unlike where you've got a Joe Gordon situation where Joe is a visionary and Gordon Gordon's ideas tend to be tactical. They tend to be, you know, sort of engineering ideas that fix problems. And
yeah, he's an architect, yeah, right?
He's an architect and he's a good one.
He'll put it together.
But he really struggles with the sort of bigger vision. He can see the house, not the village, right? Whereas Joe sees the whole world. and you have this issue with Cameron and Donna as well, where Cameron tends to want to be very high level with her vision. She, you know, when they brainstorm individual games, she gets tired and frustrated because for her, she's looking for the big idea that drives those games. She's not looking for tactical execution. She wants strategy and vision. And Donna has a bit of strategy and vision here. She can't articulate it fully yet because she doesn't have the benefit of our 30 years of further experience, or 35 years.
Or the proper support to be able to sort of prove her point, at least, right?
Yeah. She is trying to create a proof of concept. She doesn't have the concept to rely on. And it's a really interesting kind of idea about what it means to be a visionary, what it means to be inspired, what it means to have a good idea that is happening between the two women in this episode.
Well, you bring up something really interesting, which is we've already talked about this show's ability to shift, and we'll see it throughout the seasons in pairings and storylines and how relevant that is to the world of tech that we know from 30 years on. But you talk about success and failures and that perception of success based on Gordon. And I think based on the interactions between Cameron and Donna and Gordon's sort of failed attempts from the pro and the stuff that we already know, I think the show is shifting towards the fact that, and community actually being very relevant to this, sort of, you know, underlying that, it's not only about the great idea or the execution about that idea. It's that support system that allows you to put the pieces together. And like, yes, we saw that, you know, season one, because Joe had to bring all these people together. But we're seeing in a completely different light where, you're right, you know, Donna has this idea. She's got the vision, but she can't do it by herself because she needs those people to believe in her. And I feel like, again, Gordon's computer could be as successful commercially, but that innovation is not going to come on his own. So I wonder if the show is shifting towards a redefinition of success or a redefinition of failure.
Yeah, and I think it's also reshifting who gets to define that success. Now, to a certain extent, whenever anyone has launched a product in the history of, you know, selling things, it has been down to whether or not the consumers want to buy it.
Yeah.
But there are also two different philosophies going on here. So I think Joe, and to a certain extent, but certainly Cameron, have a philosophy of creating something exceptional that is so good that people are drawn to it and use it whether they knew they wanted it or not, right? They are the philosophy of creating something brilliant, and if you build it, they will come. Whereas I think what Donna is starting to do is have a philosophy of building things around what people tell you they want, which is absolutely the Facebook philosophy, right? This is how we end up in a mess with Facebook being, you know, it's drowning under fake news, is because they have always prioritized doing and pushing in the direction that the community led. And the problem with communities is that they don't have a conscience or a brain in that sense. They are very instinctive and behavior driven, and they have spent a lot of time saying we must follow the behavior and never questioning whether or not the behavior is something we want to encourage or not. And that has good and bad implications for the way that we proceed. But we're now starting to see a sort of divide in the very philosophy behind success, or behind what constitutes a good product.
Yes. And we're also seeing a breakdown in the power dynamics, which I think we're going to see throughout the show, right? I mean, let's face it, this is the point. But the Don and Cameron dynamic in this episode has been really interesting. And for me, one of the things that really stood out was Donna confronting Cameron and it feeling refreshing from the point of view of what you talked about around the fact that she's like, you know, you don't like it because the code isn't innovative. You don't like it because you didn't come up with it. You don't like it because it was so simple and it worked that it doesn't have to be this big, flashy thing for it to be successful and allow you to move forward. And I kind of wrote, is it Donna's sort of turn to have a meltdown? I feel like she has to go through that. And we've seen Cameron sort of have that meltdown or sort of that pressure in season one. She's not having it here, which we praised, right? We said she's being very mature to see things through. But Donna's gotten to a point where she's getting to a dead end And now it's not just about whether someone pays the electricity bill or whether she's dealing with children around that workspace. It's more fundamental than that. And she finally has something she believes in that is hers, right?
Yes. And I mean, the show draws that out with the parallel with children, right? In this idea of like, how much of yourself do you put into a creative idea? Now, I do a creative job. For those listeners that don't know, I'm a copywriter. And like 99% of the time, and certainly 100% of the time in my job, I'm writing on behalf of someone else. And so one would think that that leaves a big distance between me and my writing, because when I'm writing as a client, as another voice, you think I don't put as much of myself into it. Of course you do, because you can't help it. You put some of yourself into everything. So when you get feedback, it's always, you always have to take a second and go, it's not about me, and have the Zen moment. And I think Donna up until now has seen things as an engineering challenge. And now she has an idea that has some of herself in it. And that's why she can turn to Cameron with that insight and go, do you just not like it because it didn't come from you? And all this time we've known all along, right? Cameron has always made it very clear that her ideas are her. When the personality got stripped out of the giant, it was a personal affront.
Yes.
And Donna hasn't really had that. Donna has had it's about the product. It's about, you know, the end game at the end of the day. This is not about me. It reflects on Cardiff, not me personally. You know, she's always had a nice, healthy distance from it. But community, she struggles with that. That was an idea of hers, and she sees it coming to life, and she has put a little bit more of herself in it. Now, she may still be someone who doesn't really care about it being, you know, Community by Donna Clark, but she is invested now in a way that I don't think she's ever been this level of invested before. And of course, the show brings it out by having this whole thing around children and responsibilities. And Cameron sends that god-awful message, which just completely undermines Donna's credibility with this team of... Of course, the fact that they are all basically man babies doesn't help, because not one of them has the responsibilities of a parent or can empathize with motherhood in any way. The only one, in fact, that does is Tom, to a degree. And that we've already established with Tom that he lives with his mum, that he's actually quite close to his family. So he is slightly more respectful of that relationship than anybody else in that room. And so, you know, she sends this disastrous message, and now she's undermining not only Donna's professional baby, but her actual babies as well. So it's, you know, she's just really taken a scythe to this whole relationship. Like, she really needs to be very careful now.
What a relatable moment, because who hasn't hit reply all by accident or forwarded an email with something in there?
Oh,
so I'm glad that the show is recognizing that, because it happens. 100%. Look, I agree with you. I feel like I don't have any children and I'm not a woman, in case that wasn't clear. But I'm sure a lot of parents feel like Donna feels, where they just want to hide in the bathroom and not have to give themselves to everyone all the time. And I didn't like that. Gordon was like, she was like, am I a bad mother, this and that? He was like, yeah, you are, get up and go.
I got the feeling he was joking. Because he was the first one to suggest, like just stay in here, run a bath, run a real bath or whatever. So I got the feeling he was winding her up, which absolutely, like, I do have a kid and my husband absolutely would have said something like that just to wind me up on purpose, like just as a joke. And I should say he's a very hands-on, excellent parent. So like he is no Gordon. So, everyone who has ever, and I think there are parallels for people who don't have children. Like, there are other things in their life, like maybe they're looking after parents, or maybe they have a very dependent sibling, or...
Yeah, it's what you carry, the responsibility you carry with you or on you.
Or maybe it's your job or whatever. Like, everyone can find a relationship that is equivalent to having children, that where the demand never switches off. And you know the demand never switches off, so you have to find a space where for a while you can put the demand on mute. And her kids are really young as well. My kid is a bit older than those two kids. And therefore, you know, with every passing year, I'm trying to claw back some of the thing and go, no, talk to me about more things. Don't run off and talk to your friends. I've got the opposite problem. I'm very special. Come to mummy. absolutely everyone can identify with that. And what Donna is doing in that moment is not just hiding from her children, but hiding from the whole debacle with Community, which is her other child. And with Cameron, who I think that she has come to view as one of the children that she has to look after at Mutiny, because I like Donna has instantly taken a mother hen role to all of those boys.
Yeah.
She's the one that makes sure the bills are paid. She's the one who like tries to stop them from absolutely turning it into a clubhouse. And I think later down the line, when we sort of shift into talking about narrative and symbolism, we could probably talk about startup culture a little bit there as well. But, you know, she has taken this maternal role with absolutely everyone. But then there's this one baby that she wants people to pay attention to, and they're writing it off. And the frustration there must be absolutely palpable.
We can jump into narrative. I think this is a great segue, actually, to talk about what actually happens in the episode and what sort of drives it forward. And I actually loved the episode, and there was something very confident about the way that the episode was set up. And if you guys have been listening to us this far, you'll know that I love me an episode that feels, not that it's not filler, but like really sets out a mission from the get-go. And it does from how the episode once again, for example, starts with all the main characters sort of like starting out, setting up their day. This really feels like a 24-hour episode. Like things are happening in the span of those 24 hours. It's not jumping around. It's not trying to do anything. And I like that because one of the things that I wrote down was it felt like a big milestone was sort of happening, but without a clear, here's what we need to do, here's what worked, and here's where we're going. Kind of would have liked the Comdex episode last season to be a little bit like this. And I know that's conflicting because apparently most of you like it. I'm sorry. I liked it. I just didn't feel like it was, the structure wasn't something that I would have expected it to be. But this feels more like that because it sets up like a nuclear sort of conflict and the balance between what is going on at Mutiny and what is going on at sort of Western Group. The show has shifted now to show us the interesting things, which, you know, I think we could all agree it's Mutiny rather than what Joe's trying to do. I think what Joe's trying to do is more like a character piece. We don't know if that's going to succeed or not, but it doesn't feel like it's make or break, right? It feels like Joe might move on to the next thing and Gordon might get distracted for a while until that sparks something else. I'm guessing, I don't remember the rest of the episodes, but it really does feel like that kind of, let me go do the dishes so that the back of my brain does some of the other creative work without me noticing. But this to me feels like they kind of created a show within a show from like the values that I think you're going to talk about around startup culture and stuff like that, because the mission is suddenly different, right? And it doesn't feel like it's a battle of control like season one. It feels like, yes, there's elements of that, but it feels like there's more at stake. There's more personal elements being put at play here that will be make or break.
Definitely. And I think, you know, what we've always talked about the show being very good at is establishing a sort of sense of time and place. And just thinking for a second about the wider narrative, I mean, it would be very easy for this show to just sort of leap from technological revelation to technological revelation. We've talked about the fact that they know that community is going to be a big deal, that social media is going to be a big deal. And, they, you know, before the term social media ever exists, they're already like creating the groundwork for that. But they're also thinking about the whole culture in a really rich and interesting way. And what the narrative is doing now is setting up, like we said, it's setting up different philosophies of product, different philosophies of success and failure, different approaches to creativity, different ways of owning creativity. It's now also setting up different ways of working. It's saying, you know, there is the corporate way where, you know, if you're lucky, you do what Joe did and spot a gap and say, we can exploit this gap and kind of grow and proliferate that way. And then the startup culture, which is we're trying to create something new and different. And Cameron spends a lot of time, I think, in this episode, because obviously they're, you know, they come to this crunch point about whether or not people are going to be paid and, you know, how you view your relationship to work in this episode. And, you know, this culture of, you should put the work first, you should put the outcome first and not worry about what's coming into you, is it's complicated. And I think we're still seeing this play out now. I think both of us have worked in environments that sort of demand that kind of idea from us. And it's a conflict. It's a conflict, particularly, I think, for people with other responsibilities. It's a conflict for people like Donna, who have, like, family. So, like, it's not a big conflict for her because Gordon's got all this money now. But if he hadn't, it was going to be a major issue.
And she's not really bothered by that, it seems like. You know, she's like, okay, good, have fun with your money. Like, this is not... And I think the reason for that, to add to your point, is because you're expected to also put, you know, you into that work. Like, you're not just going to go in there like they did at Cardiff and just, yeah, use your skill set, but then detach from the project. You have to put yourself there. Like, this is almost, well, they compared it to art a lot of times, but if the author is not ingrained with the final product, then it doesn't stand out. And that's really tough, because not just from a failure or success point of view, but from a, how do you balance things out when you're plugged in basically 24/7?
Well, I'd be really curious to know sort of what the resolution is in the minds of the show's creators and things like that. That's a question I would love to ask Christopher's one and two, is, you know, where do they fall in this? Because obviously they do a job that is inherently creative. They did this to tell a personal story, to tell some personal ideas. You know, there was a history in the family of, you know, people working in technology in the Silicon Prairie and all the rest of it. So where do they come out with this? It seems like the what's being set up here is that you can work 9 to 5 and then go home, but you'll miss 5 to 9 and you'll miss opportunities. And Joe is very good at spotting opportunities because he doesn't know how to stop working. So, you know, if you work 9 to 5, you can produce a product, but you can't be a driver of ideas. And if you work 24/7, you can drive ideas, but you maybe don't have a life. And I don't know if they've come to a conclusion. Maybe they haven't. Maybe they're still like, because I think we all keep an open mind about when it's worth it and when it's not.
Yeah.
But have they come to any sort of conclusion about the right way to approach things? Is there a right way? Because I think we all know that people go into startups and things like that and then they burn out. We see it with Tom in this episode where he's collecting carts at the supermarket to keep things going, because
poor Tom,
he's like...
This is the only time you'll hear me say, poor Tom.
I know, Tom is a complicated beast, because he's not... He, from the very start, hasn't been all that likable, but he is quite sympathetic. And it's you get complicated feelings around Tom, where he is sometimes difficult and weird, but also seems to have a more awareness of the dynamics that are going on than some of the other people who, you know, just kind of like want to sit there 24/7 cracking open soft drinks and like beer kegs and just going round and round. But yeah, it's a philosophically interesting episode in terms of narrative, in terms of what it tells us about the different ways people work and the different ways people find meaning. And maybe we should have said this in the character section, but I do find it interesting that for the first time, I think this season, we get to see Boz properly bozzing.
Yes.
So yes. Like, he goes back to his roots as a salesman. And like, you know, as a parent, I wasn't completely convinced by the way he won over that mum, because I'm like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of parents would have heard him going, oh, you're talking to these people online, and would have been like, who the hell are you talking to? Who are these people? It's like, I met one of my friends I have known for a long time now through an online review writing site, and her brother had this like running joke that I was going to be like some spotty 15-year-old boy in his mum's basement in Inverness. I don't know why Inverness. There's nothing wrong with Scotland. I don't know why they are from Scottish family. Maybe that's why. But there was this like running joke that people on the internet are not who they say they are. And I think at the time, with like online being such a nebulous idea, I don't think it would have been that easy for him to win her over.
But they might not be who they say they are, but it doesn't matter, because this guy, that's who he defines as friends. And I think that's the point, right? It's about that social element. Yeah, they could be 50-year-olds for all we know, right?
Yes. It is. Look, it may be the most on-the-nose bit of the entire narrative of that episode, but I appreciated it. It felt at one with the rest of the episode. It didn't stand out. I had a wry smile at that point a little bit, but
it was a bit cringe, but effective.
No, I don't know whether they started with the episode title Play With Friends or whether it was really obvious by the time they got to the end, but they do manage to bring it into every single level of it, from the way Joe and Gordon interact, the way Donna and Cameron interact, the way they interact with the other people at Mutiny, and the way Cameron interacts with Tom, and, you know, the very fact of community, and the fact that actually when Cameron has her big revelation about what the next stage of Mutiny's gaming should be. She is effectively taking inspiration from Community and doesn't acknowledge it, but she is.
I'm just so glad they didn't call this Games People Play, which is like every CW show has to have an episode called Games People Play. So thank you.
You can't have that episode title unless you have some sort of mysterious woman in heels. And like you have to have some sort of Gossip Girl scenario going on to get an episode title like that through in the bag. But, you know, we probably should have talked about this in character. We're not being very good at sticking to our buckets, but Cameron and Tom probably deserve a little moment here to go. It's a really, the only thing we can compare Cameron and Tom to is Cameron and Joe. Like, that's the only time we've seen Cameron in a sort of romantic or sexual context with somebody else. And clearly there is something, you know, even before anything happens, there is clearly something brewing between these two for the last few episodes. And it seems like she is falling into the same pattern of, if someone inspires her or respects or admires her inspiration, she also finds them attractive. Like, it's like she needs someone to orbit her understanding and orbit her inspiration and go, yes, you know, it's like she needs a satellite. And Joe, it could never work with Joe because he was too strong an opposing force to be a satellite.
He's a planet. He's not a moon.
Exactly. He's just got too much of a center of his own center of gravity to ever be. And you know, then they have that argument of, you know, it wasn't a heartbeat, it was an echo. She thinks that he's a fake, but actually what's happening there is you've got just two people who are very, very invested in themselves in different ways. Like, Joe is definitely more selfish than Cameron is, but they're very invested in themselves and their ideas. They get all their self-worth from what they can produce from their minds. And Tom is creative. He is interesting. Yeah. He came on board because he hacked a thing and solved a problem and spotted an idea. Like, we know that Tom absolutely has potential here as a creator. It feels at this point like he's being set up to be Cameron's satellite, to feed ideas and reflect ideas into her, to kind of to bolster her confidence and bolster her sense of sureness.
I mean, you can also compare their relationship and their dynamic to Joe and Sarah, and Sarah's nowhere to be seen, right? I mean, that tells you everything. But Joe and Sarah, I feel like they have, like, they've always built, seemingly, their own little separate little bubble where, like, that work doesn't get in the way. Like, they don't use each other for inspiration, motivation, innovation, or anything like that. It's kind of like, I'm going to go do my own thing, but you're just there for, like, a base and to tell me that all the stuff that I've done in the past is okay type of thing, or acknowledge it. But Cameron and Tom's relationship, I don't think it has the sparks, obviously, that the other ones had, but they don't really need it maybe at this point. And again, this is an episode about priorities, right? And different stages of life, I guess. Why else would Dana be worried about being pregnant? Like, she's already done that. She's already had two grown kids. She can finally do the things that she probably wanted to beforehand. And this kind of feels the same. Like, this is Cameron's way of just maybe, I'm not even going to say a mature relationship, but maybe something more up to her speed around maybe age and background.
Definitely. And I think if we think of it as in the context of play with friends, they are friends. Like, there is a friendliness that sits in their relationship, which she did not have with Joe. With Joe, there was like equal sexual connection, and then there was working for him and having to, you know, squabble over who gets to be in charge of what in terms of the project. And, you know, can she have her team, and how much can she lead, and does she have more influence with Gordon? And it's a weird kind of competitive thing. She doesn't have that with Tom because she's, I know she talks about there not being a boss, but she is definitely first among equals there. So, you know, she doesn't want to be a boss, but she is the boss whether she likes it or not. And she doesn't have that with Tom, and it's sweeter and more friendly. But the question is, as the audience, obviously, we like the idea of our four main characters staying in their little groupings because we've got invested in them. And there's a natural feeling, I think, that when someone like Tom comes in, that you go, excuse me, how are you going to screw this up? Because we don't like our foursome being too fragmented. And of course, you've got Sarah as well. And I remember the first time around not warming to Sarah or Tom. And now I look back and I think it's actually nothing to do with the characterization of these people. It is literally just to do with the fact that it's disrupting my ideas of how to pair these people up. Even though I can perfectly see that Joe and Cameron doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, again, if you're going to be added to the main credits, you got to be damn good at, you know, what you're bringing to the table, in my eyes.
That's a good question, actually. Because they add Alexa Palladino, but does Tom get added? I don't think he did.
I don't know if he does this season. I have to check. But, you know, check their contracts. Send me their contracts.
Send the contracts. And from the beginning of this season, we had Alexa Palladino in the credits. So we feel like there's more potential for her to come, even though she's nowhere to be found really in any significant way in this episode.
Yeah.
We feel like there's more to come for her.
A few other bits on like narrative and symbolism is something that I put down in sort of kind of parallel to it, I guess. I did love some of the very relevant conversations about gaming. I mean, I love gaming. I'm a gamer myself. And the whole comment around online gaming versus like cartridges and stuff like that, which is still a thing going on today, right? And, you know, I love me a cartridge. Give me a physical thing any day. But I do love that they are having these conversations about, again, innovation versus creative versus like, we're starting to think about like the platform that things are being built on, which is not something that was so publicized maybe in the past. Like these days, it's all about in the gaming space, like not just graphics, but like, you know, what's the frame rate versus the quality of the output and how many teraflops, blah, blah, blah. Before it was like you plug it in and you play it and you appreciate the contents for what they are. And so it's really interesting to me that they are having sort of these I mean, they should because they're kind of these engineers and these coders, etc. But I love that they do bring those elements to it and that there is this sort of like honor amongst gamers. Like there's this loyalty that is either whether it's broken or not, it's kind of also there. And this is our kind of, yes, Cardiff developed software, but this is kind of like our first look at like a platform that isn't like hardware, I guess. And so the dynamic around who they're selling it to is going to change, right? And I think you've talked about this, where yes, Donna's seeing an opportunity built by the audience that is risk and reward, right? You know, like a hardware is going to get thrown in the second shelf, was it? Not the last one, not the bottom one, not the top one. It's going to be the second shelf. And then you're going to move on to the next cycle. This isn't that. And I think it's just a very interesting way of how they approach the design of their software and their product. And I was wondering, is this the first time they think up a player-on-player online multiplayer game?
I mean, it certainly looks like that, doesn't it? And there's that whole sequence with the kind of first-person player. I've forgotten the actual name for it, but the sort of camera angle in Cameron's face with the kind of single shooter sort of setup there. And while you were talking, what I found really interesting is what changed that conversation. Like, I think in the gaming world, you can assume safely that people who were producing games were having these conversations about whether online was the future or blah, blah, blah. But what made that conversation a fan conversation was community, right? That space that existed to bring what had been a developer chat to what fans preferred, what they wanted to use, what they were interested in. And then you get, and it sort of mimics perhaps music and moving from vinyl to CD to cassette to streaming to MP3 and all the rest of it. You know, any kind of technological progress in the past, the conversations have been in the hands of the people doing them. And now the conversations are in the hands of the people talking about them as well.
Or commercial, right? Like, oh, we got to shift to this because we're getting incentives financially to do it, really, to change to that format, 100%. Also, this might not be correct, but the end scene, the end frame of Donna being potentially pregnant.
I think she is. I think the turning blue is an actual, like, oh, right, that's definitely a pregnancy.
Oh, but did they show that?
Yeah,
I thought it just ended on her eyes.
No, you see it in the little plastic thing. It was an old school test, right, where they had like test tubes and shit. Like I peed on a stick, guys. So, you know, we've moved on. But yeah, I think
I did a COVID lateral flow test, which I'm guessing is the same.
That's
thing.
Always fun.
No, but I was gonna write.
Did you pee on your lateral flow test? Because maybe you didn't really have COVID.
I will not publicize that. Is this our first big cliffhanger? And even if she is pregnant, it kind of feels like it might be.
Yes, I think the cliffhanger is, what the hell is she going to do about it? Because I think she's made very clear through hiding from her children, through the response that she had to Cameron and all the rest of it, that, you know, she is ready for her moment, right? She has waited. She has raised the children.
Yeah, yeah.
She has raised Gordon and let him do his thing. Now, Gordon is taken care of, right? He found his own way. He made his money. Now she doesn't have to babysit him because he's got the money and time, or at least she thinks she doesn't. The fact that he's collapsing in server rooms suggests that maybe somebody needs to be watching out for him. Obviously, he should watch out for himself, but you know what I mean? You know, she's done her bit, and now it's her chance to raise a creative baby. And having another actual child is a really, really big question mark. And then there's lots of question marks that come off the back of that, which is like, is she going to tell Gordon?
Well, yeah.
If she does tell Gordon, what's his reaction going to be?
Is she going to lean on Cameron?
Is she going to tell Cameron? Yeah, absolutely. Like, is she going to do the look, you know, at least you're another woman thing, which I think sometimes we are prone to do. We're prone to sometimes go to our own people and go, oh, at least you're another one of me, even if their outlook isn't particularly sympathetic.
I mean, you might find that the next episode starts with she's done it and she hasn't told anyone and she's just made that decision because she had to. I mean, I don't remember and I don't know. But yeah, it does really feel
like... No, it really could go either way at this point. And yeah. Or, you know, if she goes ahead and decides to keep the child... I'm sad to say, not all pregnancies are successful. So we simply don't know. But we do know that, you know, for her, it is not going to be a straightforward decision. And I did the cringe that I always do, which is when people always find out they're pregnant by vomiting. Can I just say, for the record, that about 50% of people don't actually get morning sickness. And in most people, it kicks in quite a few weeks in. So... You know, I know that every TV show likes to start with women vomiting, but actually, I didn't get any morning sickness. Sorry if that makes anybody hate me, but, you know, it happens.
This is a different podcast. Well, all we're going to talk about is pregnancy reactions and
vomiting.
Vomiting, and I'll tell you another one, season finale weddings.
Oh, God, yeah, that's a whole other... Yes, guys, if you want us to do the pregnancy, vomiting, and weddings podcast...
Comment below.
Exactly, let us know.
Another, I think... worthy aspect of the show that we should talk about this episode is Gordon passing out while he's setting up this mainframe thing when Joe brings him a new Coke.
I know the Coke thing did make me laugh because it was like, guys, the in-joke at this point has gone beyond the pale. But
maybe it's just Mad Men comparisons.
And I mean, that scene, and yeah, we'll talk again about the visuals of it in a minute, but it's quite sudden. And I found it quite affecting, actually, despite the kind of dodgy Coke joke, that him kind of doing his normal thing and then suddenly breaking down, and not while he was running or not while he was kind of working long into the night or anything like that. Like, he's working evenings, but he's not worn out.
He's rich. He doesn't need to work. Like, he can't be tired. But if you're rich, you're not tired.
He's not worn out or anything here. It's not, we don't have a context of him having, you know, burnt the candle at both ends or whatever, but he is clearly not taking care of himself. We know from previous episodes that he's having, you know, that he has been more reliant than he should be on stimulants.
Substances.
So yeah, that was, it was interesting to put that into the flow at this point because I guess we're setting up something for Gordon here. We're setting up some sort of ongoing health concern, which started with the new Coke episodes and is kind of moving forward, which, could lead to some really interesting story. So, having talked about Gordon then and his collapse, it seems a good moment to move into... photography, production, all those kind of elements. When we talked about enjoying our wonky camera angles, we certainly had a few to choose from in this episode. So where do you want to start?
I mean, I know I said that we were going to get past the whole, yes, the camera's tilted, but my God, sometimes it's, they might as well just flip it upside down. I mean, all joking aside, I mean, the camera in Mutiny is getting very, very tilted and it's falling off a cliff, you know, the edge of a cliff. And I think that really is what they're sort of trying to, what they're trying to tell us here. But I think this episode, what I really liked was that there are a lot of beautiful shots, actually. There's a lot of tilting and sort of moving around. And I noticed that a lot of the times when we're in Mutiny, the camera stays put and just pans around characters rather than follow them around. It does that with sort of very specific characters. And I think that sort of brings us, in a weird way, closer to that set piece, meaning we are just spectators rather than actively involved from the point of view. So we'll talk about that sort of first person shooter aesthetic, which I really liked, but which was very much sort of new for the show. But I feel like when a lot of times throughout the season, actually in Mutiny specifically, the camera's just sort of also thrown there. And one of the things that I like is that a lot of the things around it are exposed. And we saw a lot of this in season one where, for example, you would see the light fixtures and stuff like that, which usually, you know, the rule number one of like 1920s cinema was don't tilt to the ceiling because the ceiling is the studio and you don't want to expose anything, right? And, you know, a lot of French cinema started breaking with that and were like, no, I'm going to show you the ceiling. Orson Welles started sort of playing with that and dressing it up so that you would get like a more wholesome idea of that space. And so we know the show will do this and in part it's to sort of showcase that technology or the things that power the things. But it really does feel like in Mutiny, there is a lot of exposing the innards of a lot of these computers, the mainframes and all that stuff. And there's a beautiful shot of Donna as she tries to fix the XTs where it's just very artful, if that's even a word, in relation to what we're seeing. You know, again, everyone go pause this recording, Google computers, and you're going to get, or internet, and you're going to get blue cables, you know, like polygons, the usual things that you associate with the words internet and computer, etc. And so I think this plays with that light and it plays with those angles in a really nice way. And it's kind of like, it's just the tapestry that the characters are pit against. It showcases how it consumes them, certainly that in that shot with Donna, right? And one thing that I wanted to mention, and maybe you noticed it too, was that for the first time, we see a reflection from the computer screen, not on Cameron, but on Donna and Lev as they're checking out the community rooms, right? And we know from season one that the reflection from Cameron is usually because it comes out of her own mind. And in this case, we see her checking out the rooms and typing and talking shit about Gordon to her bae from behind, right? From camera on the screen, whereas for the first time we're seeing this reflection. And that's how I think we know that also perspective is shifting and really the root of the problem is, well, yeah, it's not Cameron's idea.
Absolutely. I think the show has a code now. When someone is owning, developing an idea, you earn the right to be seen through the machine. Whereas if you are just interacting with something, like when Gordon is playing games with people online, or when, as you say, when Donna has in the past been sort of fiddling with things, when you're just sort of interacting or fixing or whatever, you don't get seen that way. And now Cameron is for the first time being seen from the outside of something, because she didn't create it, right? It's on her network, but she didn't create it. And what's interesting about Mutiny is from the start, and obviously, it's a show, which means there's different directors in different episodes and things like that. But from the start, Mutiny has had a very different feel in terms of the way the camera is held and moved than anywhere else. It's been more organic. It's been more handheld. And you're really right. It's like that those shots of Donna try to meld those two things. The idea of this kind of blue, angular world that we now think of as the internet or the computer world, with this really like, and when I say organic with Mutiny, I almost mean it literally. Like the place is a pit. You could imagine things growing out of the corners. Like it's moldy and it's crappy and no one's looking after it because they're all so focused on the work. And the way that it's filmed kind of really highlights that. It highlights the chaos. It highlights the startup culture and the feeling that there is no line between work and play and life. Like everyone lives in there, everyone eats in there, everyone sleeps in there, some of them have sex in there. It's just like everything is like this kind of mush of life, and the way that the camera moves in that building really reflects that.
I mean, I think the interesting thing in comparison to maybe season one, or it, you know, it does kind of depend on the episode, but with Cardiff and with the dynamics around building the giant, we had a lot of close-up shots. Like you would see sort of the silhouette of a character sort of out of focus to symbolize or to showcase that there were more people in the room, that it was always through someone else almost as that you were getting through. But what we're seeing with Mutiny in particular, which is where a lot of this episode took place, is wide angles, which we hadn't really seen before. And so to your point around seeing the things that grow out of the edges, yes, we can see the empty cans of beer. We can see the mold growing. We can see so many cables and things that it's almost eating them up. I mean, I compare this in my notes to True Detective season one, which is a very big stretch because I'm comparing it to a scene of Carcosa, as they call it, which is like weird trees in a forest kind of consuming people and eating them up. But genuinely, it does feel like some of the cables and everything is so messy that it is sort of, you know, it's a tangled mess that is sort of eating them from the inside out to an extent because of what you're sort of mentioning. They live there, they do everything there, etc. And I do like the aesthetic of Mutiny itself. And I think the wide angle really lends itself to other nice little nudges. I think there was like a nice touch where it's at level one or something.
Yeah. I know we just talked narrative, but that's obviously feeds back into the narrative as well, because you get Tom taking this picture and what's his name? Is it Wonder Boy? Comes in and chaotically disrupts it. This is terrible of me, but they have all started to merge into one. Like I can tell Lev and Yo-Yo and everyone else is just a blur.
Yeah.
And you know, he obviously comes in and disrupts it in his pants and all the rest of it. And even when you're looking at Mutiny through Tom's lens, they keep the same sense of like this wide-angled chaos. Like even Tom manages to capture the same thing like through his lens within a lens. It's really very brilliant.
It's great. And I think there's other elements on this, and we were chatting a little bit offline about the fact that the power dynamic when Joe goes to I forget the name of the mid-level executive, where Joe's trying to pitch his idea for what he ends up doing illegally on the mainframes. And it's really interesting because again, traditionally in film, TV, the language used to symbolize power and subject is by the camera angle, where we've always seen Joe sort of from below so that you can see him towering over, and the person at lesser sort of power is the opposite, right? It's looking down on them. And it's really funny because that is happening here, but Joe isn't the one in power. It's the other one. So it messes with you.
It's really fascinating because so many other times when Joe has been pitching something, he has either been commanding the energy or he's been sitting down but leaning forward, right, across the table. Like he even when they're both at the same level, he commands more space, right? He spreads himself out. We've talked many times. In fact, we inadvertently possibly may have offended Toby Huss this week by talking about how enormously tall Lee Pace is.
Sorry, Toby.
On our Twitter. Sorry, Toby. Like, who is as tall as Lee Pace? No one's as tall as Lee Pace.
Lee Pace appreciation moment.
Hollywood giants. And Toby Huss appreciation moment, because the man's wonderful. Toby, the invitation's always open. Come and join us.
Toby, I just sent you a link. Check your DMs.
But, you know, you've got this... The camera loves playing with that, right? They like playing with how disproportionately tall and imposing Joe can be compared to everybody else around him. Like, I don't think Scoot McNairy is particularly short, but everyone looks short in comparison to this imposing guy, right? And they play with that a lot. They manage to make Joe look uncomfortably large a lot of the time. Here, his uncomfortable largeness is used like awkwardness. It's the first time I think that we've ever seen, well, not the first time ever in the show, but one of the rare moments where we see Joe look awkward and out of place. Yeah. Like he's trying to do the right thing, right? He's trying to pitch legitimately, but also he has a history of nailing this. Like he pitched the giant to Cardiff, you know, he completely changed the way that all was going. He railroaded Nathan and Bars and all the rest of it. He obviously did similar things at IBM, is implied. You know, he even, like in his game with Jacob Wheeler, he initially came out lower, but then, you know, he knew how to play the game, like by accepting the job and not making difficulties out of it.
Yeah,
he sort of gained ground and then, mm-hmm. you know, sent the gift or whatever. You know, he railroaded his boss in that as well. And this is the first time I think he's come up against a blocker that he couldn't just talk his way out of. And it's personal as well, because the guy kind of says to him, you know, oh, I was here when she divorced the last guy. You know, you guys come and go. And the idea that his personal relationship is a blocker in getting this professional thing done is quite horrifying to him, I think. And the way the camera angles keep us at the desk, as if the desk is the center of power, which it is in that scene, it's subtle and brilliant and absolutely beautiful.
Hats off to the director of this one, because this one really feels like the photography, the aesthetics, it's all directly linked with the narrative. And obviously we've seen more conceptual, maybe abstract stuff like the Hurricane episode, or, you know, when we get into sort of Gordon's mind a little bit, his dreams. But this one really feels like it really ties that up. I mean, going back to that close-up, that extreme close-up of Donna when she figures out that she's pregnant and you don't know what she's going to do, etc. I mean, we've never really had that shot of just Donna's eyes, just those reactions. We've had reaction shots before. And in fact, I feel that's where the show kind of excels, because it's not about who's giving it, but rather who's receiving it and their reaction to a lot of those things and how they play off each other. But there's a really interesting scene in the parking lot when Joe and Gordon are, when he's trying to sort of get him in. And Gordon is centered in the middle of the frame. And again, you know, breaking the rules is part of the fun. You know, usually it's like, well, you're talking to someone, you leave empty space where the other one should be, so that when the shot changes, it creates this sort of comprehensive dynamic. But when things are placed in the middle, they're not aesthetically pleasing. That's not why they're in the middle. It's actually uncomfortable for things to be placed in the middle because of the rule of thirds. It's undecisive, and it's Gordon not knowing where to proceed and where that's going to lead him. So again, I feel like a lot of these things are directly linked. And then, of course, we get that FPS, first-person shooter aesthetic, when the camera's sort of following Cameron as if she was in that video game and as if she was shooting things. And I think that's the first for this show to actually, one, show us Cameron's point of view that isn't like a reflection on the screen, but also directly linked to something they were developing. I can't remember if it was a tracking shot, meaning a shot that doesn't have cuts up into a certain point, but I think they made it really, really fun. And actually, the lighting and the darkness around it, something about the quality just made it feel like a home movie kind of thing, like someone's recording it with them, like there.
Well, I should say that some of this made me really interested because it is a new kind of thing for the show to use. I had a little poke around into the background of the director. So the director for this episode is Kimberly Pierce. And I think I am correct in using the pronoun she. I understand she's genderqueer, but her Wikipedia page still says she, so hopefully I'm correct in this. My apologies if not. While we can't go back and recorrect this, I will correct it in the notes if people tell me otherwise. She directed Boys Don't Cry. She directed Stop Loss, which is about soldiers' experiences in the Iraq War. She directed the remake of Carrie. So her background is really difficult, complicated subjects, or in the case of Carrie, horror as well. And I think there are elements of that that come into the way that she approaches some of those scenes. So particularly with that first person shooter shot, it's quite dark. It's quite, and as is typical of a lot of these games, obviously, that, you know, when you're trying to reenact a kind of wartime environment, it's quite intense and quite uncomfortable. And she brings that into it quite a few bits. Like, she brings that sense of claustrophobia, even when they're having a good time chatting in the cupboard, it's still very claustrophobic and very tight. And she just, I think, when you talk about kind of linking the camera so closely to the narrative, I think that she's just somebody who makes films where there is a truckload of nuance, and she has to think incredibly carefully. Like, I'm not saying that other directors don't, but there are some subjects that you take on where you just have to be really, you have to second guess and second guess and guess second guess to make sure that you are putting across, particularly with Boys Don't Cry, which was a real story about a real tragic murder victim. You know, you have to make sure that you are presenting nuance in a really careful way through the way that you're telling your stories. And that I think brought a lot of richness to this episode.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that I wrote down about lighting is that the lighting throughout the episode really helps highlight or actually hide sometimes some of the details around it. For example, you know, when Cameron runs into Tom in the supermarket, at night, you know, in the middle of the night, and she's sort of covered up, and the lighting is just coming sort of from the sign and the street lamps. I mean, there's something really moody about that. And obviously, Tom's been sort of concealing that part of his daily life. And so obviously, it's a dead given, right? But if you compare that to Western Group, where Gordon is setting up, he's doing something illegal in this like perfectly white lit room, like fully exposed. I mean, again, it feels like they really turned it up a notch or down, depending on how they could add subtlety to some of those moments. And when Donna's looking at her pregnancy test, she's being sort of lit up from above as well. And it's just interesting to me how they can play into that and sort of the impact that it can have on that narrative, because there's a lot of ways to light Carrie Bichet, I think. And so, you know, it has to be a conscious choice to want to highlight features of her.
And I mean, you mentioned the bit in West Group, like, obviously the sterility of the server room has, for practical reasons, been established in previous episodes and things like that. But I love how every director comes in and uses the eeriness of that space. So the very white walls, the very quiet hum of the machines. And then when that hum stops and starts, depending on, because obviously the whole point of Joe's project is that he's using downtime, right? So there's a stop and a start to this kind of, that room feels like, it's like the manifestation of tinnitus. Like it's there and it's just buzzing and you don't know, you like, you get used to it and then it stops and then it starts. And it's, that whole room feels really uncomfortable. And so when Gordon collapses in it, and the whole way that that's shot with the kind of like, you just see him catch on the side of that cabinet and then it's from above, and you know, the jarringness and the otherworldliness of this room, which only really exists for machines, like people don't belong in that space, and the contrast with the very organic, people rich kind of almost stinky atmosphere of Mutiny is absolutely fascinating. Because even when we're in the executive rooms in West Group, they're a lot more, it's not as sterile because you've got the wood and the leather and all the rest of it, but you've got a lot more empty space and fewer people per even down in the kind of data processing bit, where they're a little bit more grouped together, there's still a clear definition between my desk and your desk, which at Mutiny doesn't exist, right? It's just a shifting pile of like crap merging into each other. So like, I love the way different directors come in and exploit those differences in space. I think it's really, really interesting to look at. So while we're on the subject of visuals, and I know we've sort of, in our heads, we've sort of split these categories into like production and setting, but I think this is one that kind of brings the two together, which is set design. And I've mentioned already the kind of like chaotic set design of Mutiny and the polished woods and leather of the West Group offices. And then you have the Clark's home, which over the drift from season one, where they didn't really have any money, to season two, where they do, you start getting like little details in there. So you get a little bit more artwork on the walls and everything is beginning to look a little bit more polished. And it was funny because while we were watching this episode, there seemed to be a proliferation of memes on social media about how people remember the 80s and how people who actually lived through the 80s see it. And it made me laugh because, yes, the way people think of the 80s is you're like, super neon, big, you know, padded sleeves, kind of big wide shoulders, all this kind of nonsense. And actually the way I largely remember the 80s is as varying shades of brown. And it's funny because I record this, obviously you guys can't see where we're recording, but I'm recording it literally sitting next to a G-Plan sideboard that my parents bought in 1982, 2 years after I was born. I have remembered this sideboard being in their house all my life. And when they recently downsized, I inherited the sideboard. They also still have their G-Plan 1976 dining room table and chairs, which I had to warn my husband the other day, you know, sit down gently because they're still the original 1970s chairs. They've been reupholstered once in, 40 something years. This stuff is built to last, right? So what is really brilliant about a lot of the set design, particularly in the Clark's house, is that stuff is not 80s. It's not new, because people didn't need to always buy new stuff. Or if they did, it was like one statement piece, which they were then going to keep for 20, 30, 40 years. And in looking up some of this, because I was curious, I came across an interview which some people listening may have found as well. So there is a website called Mirror 80, and the tagline is reflecting on recent retro style. And back in 2015, they did an interview with one of the set decorators from Halt and Catch Fire, a guy called Lance Totten. And actually, there's a fantastic picture of him at the top of the article where he's standing in one of those really sterile server room settings. There are some absolutely wonderful photos that he's included with this article of Cardiff, of meeting rooms and things from the set. So I strongly recommend Googling interview with Lance Totten. It's T-O-T-T-E-N. But he actually talks about this. He talks about the big challenge that they had with set design was there's not a lot of stuff left of that kind of neon 80s time, because this was a time when we were moving from slow sort of processes, slow fashion, slow furniture processes to more disposable stuff, stuff that you would not keep for very long. And then you would move on to the next thing. Style started moving faster. And really the 80s was this sort of intersection. The fast fashion movement had begun a little earlier than that, sort of post-war and after the kind of whole utility thing, once fabric started to become more widespread again, fast fashion has started moving a little bit earlier than that. But it really came into its own at this point where even in the 80s, if you think about it, there were lots of distinct styles. So there was kind of 80s does 40s, and there was this kind of sweatsuits and Jane Fonda. And so there were lots of different styles even within just that one decade, as there often are. So one of the challenges they had was, you know, how do we make this authentically 80s, but we're not going to be able to get hold of like loads and loads of authentic stuff. We'll be able to create things from scratch. And they came to this realization, this very fair realization, that actually if you were living in the early 80s, most of the stuff in your house would be 60s and 70s. It would be stuff that you'd been given, stuff that had been passed down from family, and stuff that you'd bought, particularly for the Clarks, who would have bought it in the 70s before having children and things like that, or just at the point of having children and with not much money. They would have got sort of older pieces. And so what I love is that you get that reflection, like, I don't know why I always think of Stranger Things. It's certainly not the only 80s set TV show, but that feels a little, while it does, like the living room, I think in Stranger Things does have a sense of real place. Like you've got that kind of old sofa and things like that. It does have a sense of that. But while the show in its as a whole has a slight more sense of the 80s are happening, observe the 80s fashions, in Halt and Catch Fire, they're much more like, look, this is Dallas. This is Dallas in the early 1980s. It's not like the cutting edge of the fashion parade here. It's not, you know, where they're going to have lots of this. It is the Silicon Prairie. It is definitely, it's innovation in ideas, but not necessarily in fashions and set. And I love that. I really, really love that it feels familiar. It feels like watching something that, yes, I was very tiny in the 80s. Like the whole of the 80s took place between 0 and 10 for me. So I don't remember it in so much detail, but the sense impression that I get from the time, the sense of older items, of this kind of brown glass and orange and green that had, it was kind of like a hangover from the 70s, comes through in those designs. And it was just something that really peaked for me in this episode, looking at those three different sets. And I loved it, and I just wanted to mention it.
No, I mean, that's great. That's really interesting. I mean, I was not born in the 80s or alive then, but I am from South America, where a lot of stuff takes a lot of time to move forward. I mean, actually, it only takes one search on Airbnb for places in Italy or Greece to actually appreciate some of
what he's saying about my people.
I'll let you know. You know, I'll let you know when I see it in person. But
Greek furniture is in the past, and I bloody love it. Like, I'm sure Athens has many, many cutting edge type places, but like some of these places on the islands and things, they were furnished a long time ago, and that stuff is holding up.
But, you know, I worked in real estate when I was at uni, and having to show, for example, apartments in, you know, in Buenos Aires that had like pink bathrooms and toilets or brown. I've seen black toilets, brown toilets. Like you just get this like ridiculous things that are associated with not necessarily a trend or a vibe, but things that just come together because that's what's there. And I think that's also the point, right? It's not just that you're going to go, here's the IKEA collection, and you get the chair, the table, the paintings to go with it. No, it's like bits and pieces. To me, the 80s is more like, when it comes to like design of like a house and the setting. It's more like that mishmash of like a random curtain, that wallpaper that was there when you moved in, like, you know, those kinds of things. Not always the case, but certainly that point of view. And I think, again, sorry to plug this in, the Americans are a great example of a different type of significance around the setting, because we're talking about two Russian spies in the 80s that had to pretend to be American, have like that traditional American house. And so some of it was a bit glossier, but also it had to be because they weren't from there. So you can tell that a lot of that was acquired to be a set, essentially. But it does hold with some of the, it does ring true to some of the stuff that you're talking about around like a random kind of oriental mirror that you might find like at a Chinese temple that maybe might have been popular in the 80s because of that kind of exotic nature of those, like, you know, random golden things or something like that. So, no, I think that's really interesting, and it's great to see the clash between the technology side of it and the non-technology side of it, really.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've totally abused the word organic in the recording of this episode, but again, it's that feeling of if we borrow across a couple of decades, then we make everything feel more real. We make it feel more like it's grown up with these people. And yes, they can get away with a certain amount more polish in like the corporate environment, because the corporate environments will have been refreshed and redecorated and made to look kind of their time as they go along. But I want to see more of people's houses. Obviously, Mutiny is Cameron's house as well, and it's its own sort of special state of chaos. And Joe has always lived without imprinting his personality on his space. But now that he's with Sarah, their house as well is starting to feel a little bit more like a real place that people live. Like, Joe hasn't had that before. His flat was very sterile. And mostly we see him in the very sterile environments of West Group. But now I'm hoping, like with Alexa Palladino in the credits, that we're going to get to see a little bit more of his home life and the reality of his home life. Obviously, we've seen the dinner party and the bit in the garden, and it's just rooting him in something a bit more real that I really like. But yeah, set design in this whole show, I mean, I could... If there's a book out there on set design in the show, I know that there's an interview, I found that much, but if someone's written the book, let me know, because I would definitely read it.
So just to close things up, I've got a few bits of notes that I would classify as other random things, bullet points, miscellaneous, such as, I'm sure you've got some, the parking lot. We've had a lot of parking lot scenes on this show.
Oh, yeah. No, genuinely, like I hadn't noticed that. But as soon as you pointed out, I'm starting to like add them up in my head, like Joe yelling at Gordon and the thing with the machines getting ripped off in the parking lot and bumping into Tom and... Oh my God, you're right. Like, everything seems to happen in the parking lot.
Everything is a parking lot.
Oh, even actually, wasn't there some sort of confrontation? Am I right in remembering there's some sort of vague confrontation between Donna and Cameron in a parking lot?
Yeah. Well, Gordon gets ripped off.
Oh God, yeah. And then there's the hurricane and the... the Cabbage Patch Kid. Bloody hell.
Yeah. So a lot of that, which is also kind of very, very 80s in the sense that the U.S. 70s, 80s, 90s, even to today, some of those cities are very much like, here's a plaza with a big parking lot and then stores, or like a mall, shopping center. So to me, that is very, like, the concept of a mall is very 80s to me.
I mean, modern America is absolutely built around the motor car, right? Everything, you know, cities built on grids and strip malls, and in a way that, like... because we're both based in the UK, and the way that England isn't, because it was a Roman city. Well, London was a Roman city, and so many bits of this had sort of various settlements and groups before that.
Donkeys.
Yeah, and then we, you know, London burnt down and they hastily rebuilt it on the same footprint without kind of considering that maybe the carriages were going to get a little bit bigger. But anyway.
Yeah.
You've got a sense that everything is taking place around these very transitional areas where people kind of
come and go,
come in and come out constantly, come and go constantly. That's a really smart observation. I had not noticed that.
So another one that I have, and I don't know how long this has been going on for, but we don't have any ironic saying sort of t-shirts from Cameron anymore.
Do we not? The only, do you know what? I've taken my eye off the ball with Cameron's clothing a bit, because I used to be on like red watch. When is Cameron going to wear red? When she wears red, it means business.
She did have some red on the first person shooter scene.
There you go. And actually, Donna, when Donna is about to do something where she defends herself or where she stands up for herself, she tends to wear red. So she tends to kind of pick up Cameron's red color more when she's about to do something fairly dynamic. Oh, God. What else have I missed? You've been watching it. You've been watching a whole other show that I've missed. Damn it.
Well, I put when Joe, there's a scene where Joe sort of crosses his legs. I think it's when he's talking to Gordon. And it feels like he's back to like his old self, but no tie.
Yes, that's true. He has abandoned the tie once and for all.
And the last thing I've got is that I'm kind of tired of the coders like playing around all the time. Like, I get it. They're really annoying. But also, why haven't they hired any more women?
Because it's 1984 or 5? I can't remember.
I mean, I know, but...
But you'd think Cameron in particular would be on the lookout for...
Or Donna more than anything. I think Cameron will see it as competition, right? As she did Donna initially, maybe. But I don't know. It's just interesting that... Or like, I mean, I was going to say, why don't any other girlfriends show up? Like, any of these guys would have girlfriends, right?
I mean, would you date any of these people? They're all awful.
Let's see where community takes them.
The man baby thing is getting really old. And I think that there is a natural... we talked earlier about how we're not sure exactly where the creators and the writers... And the writer for this episode, the lead writer for this episode was Darby Waller, who also wrote Adventure and the 214s. So somebody who is not entirely new to the show. And it's funny because Adventure is also, I think, one where it's very much about the kind of spirit of these guys in the kind of bro-y community. And she's good at spotting that, I think. She's really good at bringing out the reality of that. And like we said, we're not entirely sure whether they come down positive, negative, or neutral on this environment where everybody plunges all of themselves into what they do. But certainly if they are drawing out any of the negatives, it's that when you live at work... all of you comes to work with you, and that including all the stuff that you would usually leave at home, which is just being a bit of a brat and being a bit lazy. And this environment that Cameron tried to set up of like, there are no bosses here. You've all got to be like responsible and do your own thing. But then sitting Tom down and telling him off for coming in late is an absolute boss move, and she knows perfectly well that there is no way of creating a world where it's completely equal. Somebody's got to be in charge, otherwise no shit's going to get done. But you're right, they're bringing out the coder's absolute worst sides. And in taking the photo and doing the whole play with friends ad, they are saying that there is a flip side to that, right? It's like the worst is also the best. You know, at its worst, it's chaos and drama. And at its best, it is free and creative and fun and warm. And you know, when people talk about offices being like a family, and this is going to go, this is, again, this should be a podcast for another time. Like my deep, deep abiding hatred of places that call themselves a family. Because when your office is calling you that, they're asking you to... forgive them for shit you're not supposed to forgive them for, because that's what you do with family, right? Is you let them off the hook for things that you would never let random strangers or even some friends off the hook for. And so when you're the place that is your livelihood asks you to be a family, that is a problem. So it means that they are dysfunctional and they expect to get things wrong. But with Mutiny, of course, you've got a bunch of people who are volunteering their time at this point in the hope that at some point they are going to get paid. So really, it is a family, and it's bringing out now the best and worst of that familial thing where you have all entered into this thing where you're like an obligation based on agreement rather than... blood or whatever it is. You've entered into this obligation that you will forgive a whole load of stuff that you're not supposed to forgive on the basis that the whole is stronger than the sum of its parts. And of course, the one thing we didn't talk about is Yo-Yo doesn't buy that shit. So he's out. And I thought that was a crying shame because I really like Yo-Yo. So I'm hoping that this is not a permanent arrangement.
Again, we gotta have a look at his contract and see where it's gonna take us.
Yeah, we're gonna go Gotta go Google him and see if he left. But in fact, we're not, because we don't want to ruin it. But yeah, so that whole vibe was fascinating. And we know that there's only two ways for a business like that to go, right? It's going to implode under its own weight, or it's going to absolutely explode. And if and when it absolutely explodes, which we're going to assume there's another six episodes in this season, so it's not about to collapse. There's got to be something that's going to happen with it, or if it collapses, it's going to collapse in an interesting way. If it gets bigger, if it does succeed, if Cameron rethinking community now that she's tried it out means that she's willing to put a bit more behind it, and we know that community is a winning concept, what does growth mean for a situation like that? Because the minute you start adding people to that kind of intense familial environment, and also that house can only hold so many people, like the minute you start adding new dynamics, what if she does bring in a bunch of women? What if she does, you know, kind of start cleaning house a bit? What does that do to the dynamic, and does it affect the creativity and the output?
And what is the soul of this company? Is it the messy, familial, you know, people that you kind of are growing up with in this thing, or is it something else? No, I think that's really interesting. And I think that brings us to a natural closer on what's going to happen coming up. So thank you guys so much for listening. I'm going to let you tell us where to find an upcoming picture of your furniture on Twitter.
Yes, I really should post a picture of the furniture, but you can find our thoughts on furniture and other things at TTTGYTTT, so the initials of the podcast, on Twitter. We've definitely been having some cool conversations there recently, so I do want to circle back to some of the things that people talk to us about on there, and I'm sure we'll bring that into future conversations, because people come to us with really interesting perspectives, and we love it. We had a really good chat this week about whether or not Lulu might have orchestrated the beating on Joe in that episode, that where we were a bit confused about whether it was Nathan or Boz or what else, who else was pulling the strings. So yeah, come find us there. There's an email address attached to the podcast there, but you've got to go there to find it. We're launching you in. And please, any way you can leave a rating and a review helps us enormously. So please do.
Great. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.